the one that appeared to me for the first time. I saw in the vision, and so it happened, that while I was looking, I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. And I lifted up my eyes, and there standing beside the river was a ram that had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram, and he was moved with rage against him and attacked the ram and broke his two horns. Then there was no power in the ram to withstand him, and he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one who could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken. And in place of it, four notable horns came up toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast the truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be? Concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of destruction, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot." And he said to me, "For 2,300 days, the sanctuary will be cleansed." Now it happened, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid, and I fell on my face. But he said to me, "Understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end." Now as he was speaking to me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, "Look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation. For the appointed time, the end shall be. The ram which you saw, having two horns, they are kings of Media and Persia. The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. As for the broken horn, and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy fearfully. He shall prosper and thrive, and destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. And he shall exalt himself in his heart. And he shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. But he shall be broken without human means. And the vision of the evenings and the mornings which is told is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future." Now I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. That far. And I'm sure at this point you don't understand it either. The commentator that Dennis was using in his class, who also did a commentary on Daniel, says he's not sure he understands it either, so we're all with you. What we do know is this. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, that was before chapter 5. As we said last time, at the end of chapter 6, we get to the point now where we're dealing with visions as opposed to history. Okay? And so we said chapter 7 went back to when Belshazzar was king. Belshazzar was the last king of Babylon. So now we're talking in the third year of Belshazzar rather than the first year of Belshazzar. And so this is Belshazzar 3, but it's still before Babylon falls. Okay? So when Daniel will say, I went about the king's business, he's talking about the king of Babylon. He's not talking about any other king at that point. Now, chapter 7, we said last week, or 2 weeks ago, was what will go on in the world. Chapter 7 was review of Babylon, and then the Medo-Persian Empire, and then the Macedonian Empire, and then the Roman Empire. This was what was going to happen in the history of the world. Why does Daniel get told that? We can only guess. But the best guess, according to E.J. Young, the commentator, is that because Daniel is a eunuch and he can't have any descendants, there won't be anybody to represent him when this is going on, and so there won't be anybody to tell him what's happening, to report to him. Okay? That's all in human thinking process. That's not the way things really are. But you would like to have your descendants around to see what happens next and to see what happens to what work the Lord used you to do. And you'd feel a little upset if you knew you weren't going to see that. I mean, how many of us think that when the Lord takes us from this world, we're going to wonder what happens to our children or our grandchildren? Well, there'd be nobody to report. So Daniel's feeling some of that. And God in his mercy is telling Daniel what's going to happen next. Now he's got two things in his mind at that point, at least as we can tell. The first is he's encouraging Daniel. The next is he's preparing something a whole lot larger. He's preparing a witness to the coming of our Savior. And he's telling all of Israel and all of the world and those who come after us what's going to happen and how he's going to bring his Son to the world. All the things that are going to happen to begin to make that possible. And history will fill in the blanks for us. Okay? He's doing that out of mercy. He's doing that out of condescension. He's doing it to encourage our hearts today as we look back and we say, you know, God didn't look at what was happening and say, ooh, how can I use this? God said, this is what I'm going to do. So that the decree of God is set in proverbial stone. The decree of God is something which God has planned, and he's planned it down to the minutest detail. That was for Daniel in chapter 7. This vision, chapter 8, seems to be the answer to a question that probably occurred to Daniel, but we don't read it. And that is, okay, you talked about the world. What about Israel? What's going to happen to them? And what's going to be the result of your promises? Next chapter, we're going to see Daniel take to heart God's promise. Okay? Daniel, what's that going to mean? Daniel's probably asking, well, what's this going to mean? How's God going to keep his people? What's going to happen? And so this chapter takes that vision. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, or you can refer to it as Belshazzar 3, if you want to know what year that is in history, well, it's probably somewhere over 560, 540 or 560 BC. We're not sure of the exact dates. In the third year of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, to Daniel. That was after the one that appeared the first time. So this is the second vision. This vision functions as just another piece in why in chapter 6, when Daniel comes in to Belshazzar's throne room, that he knows what's going to happen next. He comes in and he doesn't have to say, oh, I got to have 30 days to pray about this before I can tell you what the inscription means. He already knows, because God's already told him what it's going to mean. I saw in the vision, so it happened, while I was standing, I was looking, that I was in Susa. Well, Shushan, it says here. That's this different spelling, different use of the word for the capital of the Persian Empire. In Aramaic, it would have been Shushan. In Persian, it would have been Susa. So he was standing there in the capital city of an empire that doesn't exist. But the city did. And it was known as a fairly important city in the Babylonian Empire. But it was not the center of the world. Babylon was. But if he's standing there and God's speaking to him from there, then the center of the world must have changed. It's part of the vision, part of the information. If Daniel's standing in Susa, the palace, the citadel, and he finds out that the Babylonian Empire is going to fall, and it doesn't say specifically who that's going to be. Well, not yet. Gabriel will tell him. Okay? Then it's going to be in Persia. So when that Upharsin appears on the wall, Daniel doesn't have to figure too hard what it means. I was in the citadel, in the province, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai, smaller river than the Euphrates and the Tigris, but nonetheless, a landmark. I lifted up my eyes and I saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram, and it had two horns. I don't know much about sheep. Bobby's more expert than I am, of course, in that. But I thought they all had two horns. This one, however, is a little bit different. It had two horns. The two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. Okay. I don't know what happened to the ram, but the picture is being set before us. Susa was a city Babylon knew of. The river was a city that was a river that Daniel knew of, perhaps because in his work as prime minister, he had been sent there on various occasions. So he saw this, and beside the river was a ram with two horns. If he's standing beside the river, how many things do you think he's going to be able to see? The reason the ram stands out is because that's about the only thing he does see. And for that to be the case, it has to be pretty big. So remember, please, this is a vision. We're not talking about a giant ram that existed at one point. But the one that was higher than the other came up last. He watched the ram grow, so he saw the horns come up. Not clear. But one horn was larger than the other, and the one that was larger was the one that came up last. Historically speaking, the ram is a symbol of the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire was originally the Medo-Persian Empire. That was not because at some point the Persians conquered the Medes. That was because there was a political alliance. Darius was at one point king of the Medes. And Darius had a daughter, a young upstart by the name of Cyrus, who's a Persian, comes along and he wants to make an alliance with a king who's a little stronger and a little more well-known than he is. And so he marries Darius' daughter. But in the course of time, because Darius is much older than Cyrus, Darius will die. But Cyrus is the better soldier and the better army and the better organizer already. And so the horn that came up second, which represents Cyrus, we are going to see is the much greater. If I were to turn you back to Isaiah chapter 44, so that we get an idea of this Cyrus. Starting at 44 verse 28. Who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. He shall perform all my pleasure, saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built, to the temple your foundation shall be laid. Thus says Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held, to subdue nations before him and to loose the armor of kings, to open before him the double doors so that the gates will not be shut. I will go before you and I will make the crooked places straight. I will make the pieces break in pieces the gates of bronze and cut the bars of iron. And I will give you the treasures of darkness and the hidden riches of secret places, that you may know that I, Yahweh, who call you by your name, am the God of Israel. Now, Daniel may or may not know exactly what was said by Isaiah. He has access to it, probably, but he may not be thinking of it. And Cyrus's name isn't used here. But when the confederation between Persia and the Medes start to fight against the Babylonian Empire, Daniel's going to figure out one guy's name is Cyrus. Somebody said something about Cyrus. That Cyrus is going to be a man who rebuilds Jerusalem and who reinstitutes the worship of God in Jerusalem. It's what Isaiah said. So when Daniel stands in Belshazzar's ballroom and he's reading the handwriting on the wall and he knows that Cyrus is coming, Darius is there, Cyrus is coming, he knows the confederation, he's seen this vision about the horns on the ram and told it was Medes and the Persians, now here comes this, and a name is added, Cyrus. And so Daniel now suddenly has a piece of information that encourages him about what's going to happen to his people. What's going to happen to Israel? Okay? And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no animal could withstand him. Nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will, and he became great. So that empire that's coming, that he's going to hear about, now he's going to be able to put into perspective when Gabriel tells him the names. Okay, he knows that that's going to conquer Babylon. No one can withstand him. So there, when he stands in front of Belshazzar, he's well aware of what's going to happen next. Okay? In fact, he might even know what's going to happen and what we're going to see come to pass in 2 Chronicles chapter 36. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth Yahweh God of heaven has given to me, and he has commanded me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who among you of his people is here? May Yahweh his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem. That's what Cyrus is going to do. Ezra is going to pick that up. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah the prophet might be fulfilled, Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that the word of Yahweh might be fulfilled. The word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah. Jeremiah talks about him as Isaiah has. Jeremiah, however, is the one who gave Daniel the word of 70 years. And you're going to see that in chapter 9 when we get there, Lord willing, next week. Now, as I was considering this, Suddenly a male goat came up from the west, across the surface of the whole earth, without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Not clear whether it was a unicorn or whether it was a goat that had three horns instead of two. Okay. But the goat is a picture of the Macedonians. Now you need to understand, between the year about 540 or so in BC, when Babylon falls, and the Persians take over, and the year about 334 or 335, when Alexander's army begins to try to conquer the world, there's 200 years or so. In that 200 years, the Persians want to try to conquer the world. And so they attack Greece. You've heard about the various battles, okay? You've heard about some of the various crazy things that the Persians did. But the Persians had made themselves irritants to the Greeks. And the Greeks weren't strong enough to fight them off, though they could defend themselves occasionally. But they were now enemies. Now along comes Philip of Macedonia. And Philip is a reasonably good general and a reasonably strong man who's been wounded in battle. But his son Alexander is going to take over for him. And Alexander's the one we're probably looking at. So now there's this history of hard feelings between the Persians and the Greeks. And now here comes this male goat. Let's see, the male goat is coming from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. No, he doesn't have wings. If we talk about somebody who moves real quickly, whether he's running fast or driving fast, well, we talked about my mother for years as flying low when she was behind the wheel of the car. That's an image. It's a metaphor. Alexander's army conquered the world in less than 3 years. Boy, that's moving fast. That's what's being pictured. He came across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and he had a great and notable horn between his eyes. He came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram, and he was moved with rage against him. That was because of the animosity between the two empires. He attacked the ram and broke his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver him, the ram, from his hand. So you have a picture of the goat conquering the world. Therefore the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken. Now, we said a couple weeks ago that Alexander has a kind of a notable statement about him. That is that he claims he cried twice in his life. First, when he was 18, when his father died. Second time was when he was 21, when there were no worlds left to conquer. Okay? So Alexander grew great. But how come he was only emperor for 3 years? Because his generals poisoned him. And after they tried a second time, they finally killed him. So the notable horn disappears. And because the generals were four, interesting number, because the generals were four, the empire broke up into four parts. Four notable horns came up in the place, came up toward the four winds of heaven. You'll notice from the empires as you read your history books, one in the north, one in the south, one in the east, and one in the west. The one in the west will disappear swiftly. The one in the east will dominate the one in the north. And then he will represent the north, and he will take on the one in the south. And we'll talk a little about who's that. By this point, however, Esther has fit in to church history, to the Bible's history, as have Ezra, Nehemiah, and Malachi. Okay? So the vision is going to cover a great period of time. Alexander's four generals. Historically, they come, and that little horn that comes up, historically, let's see, verse 9. Out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly toward the great, toward the south, and toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven. That would be General Seleucus and his descendants. The other two generals, or two of the other generals, would disappear basically from history. Seleucus would conquer one of them. The fourth general was a guy named Ptolemy. And he's in Egypt. And of course, the last of the Ptolemies that you know of, and probably the only one you know of, is Cleopatra. Okay? So you have an idea of the histories that are going on. The little horn appears to be, from what we know from the Maccabees, a king by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus, well, he said he was the birth of the king or the birth of the gods, Epiphany. He took over the land to the east, took over the north, and toward the glorious land. If you're Daniel, what do you think the glorious land is? Israel, the church. Okay? But in this case, physically Israel, the land. So he's going to come there and he's going to take over, and he's going to, let's see. He grew to the host of heaven, cast down some of the host of heaven and the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. He rebelled against God, literally. Cyrus had said, Yahweh God's temple should be built. Antiochus Epiphanes says, no. And Antiochus goes and he conquers Jerusalem, expanding toward the glorious land, takes over the temple, desecrates the temple, erects an altar to himself in the place of God's altar in the temple, and for a number of years reigns and orders himself to be worshipped there. Not sure whether it works out to be 3.5 years as the number comes out to be, but the number was picture. At the same time, a priest of the Jews raises a flag of rebellion. His name is Matthias Maccabee. And so you know the Maccabees and what they do. And so what you're looking at in what's going to happen in the next few verses, he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down, his sanctuary, in capital God's. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth to the ground, and he did all this and prospered. And then I heard a holy one speaking to another holy one, who said that said to that certain one who was speaking to me, how long will this vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and of the transgression, of the desolation, of the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 days, and the sanctuary shall be cleansed. The cleansing comes under the Maccabees. They, against all logic and all human thought and odds, defeat Antiochus' army, liberate Jerusalem, most of Canaan, most of Israel, okay, and they cleanse the temple and begin to reuse the temple. And of course, you know that story if you study the Jews or Jewish lore at all. That's called Hanukkah. Okay? That cleansing of the temple and the restarting of the sacrifices is what is celebrated today as Hanukkah. Then it happened, Daniel said, verse 15. When I, Daniel, had seen this vision and was seeking what it meant, and suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai. He was a merman. He was standing above the water, walking on the water. We don't know. What we do know is that he saw something that looked like a man, and that man was in a position, most commentators think, standing in the air above the river. Which, of course, would mean that he's not looking at the normal human being. And I heard the man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called out and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So Gabriel came near where I stood. And when he came, I was afraid and I fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, the vision refers to the time of the end. So I fell on my face, he said. Daniel does not know who he's speaking to. He's not sure of who Gabriel is, but he's going to be sure of who Gabriel is. Because when he tries to worship him, Gabriel stands him back up. This vision refers to the end, or the time of the end. Time of the end of what? That's the question that needs to be answered. We'll see what we can do to answer it as we look at the other prophecies that we see in Daniel. It happened that as he was speaking to me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright and said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation. Whose indignation? Well, let's see. Israel's already going to have gone back. If Israel's already going to have gone back, then the indignation must mean that God got angry with Israel again. And that's something that I want you to remember. Gabriel comes, and part of his message, though he doesn't delineate it as clearly as we might like, is that all of the wonderful things that God has promised, that we're going to see beginning in chapter 9, because they go back to prophecy before, all of those wonderful things that God is going to do to restore Israel aren't going to work. Israel will be restored. Sacrifices will be done. There will be growth in the kingdom of God. But then the Israelites are going to fall away again. The Maccabees are going to call them back, but not to righteousness, just to political power. And so you're going to have the Pharisees develop. You're going to have the Israelites of Jesus' day develop. So it's referring to the time of the indignation. Indignation, God's going to be saying now, no more, Antiochus. I'm going to set up my kingdom again. I'm going to set up my church again. And my church is going to start to worship me. But my church is going to be made of sinners, and the sinners are going to continue to sin. Now there's an implication of that for us. Okay? And the implication is that no matter how perfect we think the church has gotten, only the Holy Spirit will be able to maintain it. We can't. We can pray, we can plead with Him, we can teach, we can be consistent. But it all depends on God. And so all of the promises depend on God's work. Ours is what God uses as much as He wishes to use. But it's all God's work. So that no man has any reason to boast. No matter how big, no matter how good, he has no reason to boast because he is a demonstration of God's grace. And God will do with him what God wants because God has purchased him. You were bought with a price. You are not your own. The ram which you saw at the time, in the latter time, excuse me, the ram which you saw having two horns, they're the kings of Media and Persia. The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. This is what we said about Antiochus Epiphanes. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper. Under his rule he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. Who's the prince of princes? God. Okay? Prince of princes? Well, Satan, you could argue. But Satan is subject to a certain prince. And by prince, you don't mean necessarily a king. You mean a warrior. Okay, so the greatest of the warriors, this king is going to rebel against, which is why he destroys the temple in Jerusalem and the worship of Yahweh. But he shall be broken without human means. I mean, after all, how much military training do four Jewish priests have? Matthias and his three sons. I mean, they may be brave men, but don't even know if they knew how to use a sword. That wasn't their job. And the people who are going to be under the authority of the Seleucids aren't likely to have an army of their own. So they're probably not going to have any Marines that they can call and say, hey, you know, your country needs you now, not the empire. Without human means, God is going to step in and he's going to intervene in this. The vision of the evenings and mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. If this is sometime around the year 560, maybe 540, somewhere in there, and this isn't going to happen until sometime after, well, let's see. You're going to talk about Antiochus Epiphanes probably somewhere in the year 200 BC. The vision is for many days in the future. But it does answer a question, Daniel. What's going to happen to your people? Your people are going to have a demonstration of God's mercy and his grace. He's going to remind them of what he has said. He's going to accomplish what he said he would do with them. He's going to send them back to Israel. Jeremiah had said that 70 years. When Belshazzar's dead, Daniel's going to say, wait a minute, you're going to count. 7 years are over. And God's going to fulfill his promise. But you'll notice what he did. He gave Daniel a whole bunch of details because it's not accidentally that these things are going to happen. These things are part of a plan. These things are how God has intended to bring about this occurrence in all of its aspects, down to the smallest details. Okay? Daniel said, verse 27, I fainted and was sick for days. Afterwards I arose and went about the king's business. But I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. What do I want you to remember? First, God's condescension to inform Daniel of what his people are. What's going to happen to his people? Daniel can't have any descendants. So it's to his nation. What they will experience. He's comforting Daniel. He's taking somebody who can't look at the future and say, my descendants are going to have anything to do with that. He's going to say, there's nothing. God says, but I want you to know what's going to happen. So that you can be comforted. So that you can recognize that I haven't left your people, even though at this point I haven't made you see the 70 years yet. That'll come next chapter. The great deliverance of Cyrus will not change Israel. It'll be wonderful, but long term it won't change Israel. They'll still be sinners, just like we are. There's only one person who can change that kind of sin. Only God. And so I want you to remember and keep in mind that in all of the things that happens as God gives you growth and grace, it all happens by his power. And I also want you to recognize that God has, with his decree, decreed the very minutest of details. It's all planned out. Even the things that you wish you wouldn't have planned. But they all must work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. So he's going to cause you to be tested, all right? But with the temptation, he will always provide a means of escape so that you need not fall. He's going to be faithful in that. In the minutest details, if I turned you to Matthew chapter 10, started at verse 27. Whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light. And what you hear in the ear, preach from the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. That isn't Satan. Are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin, and not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will? But the very hairs of your head are numbered. Do not fear, therefore, for you are of more value than many sparrows. For those of us who are experienced to the hair falling out, I thought I had a large number of hairs. God knew what they were. He knows which ones are coming out. If he's that concerned about so minute a detail, what is he not concerned about? The answer is nothing. If you can sell two sparrows for a penny, what you and I would call a penny, then God's decree, since none of those sparrows fall to the ground without his will, without his having planned the death of so small an issue as a small bird, one that you don't even eat, what is he not planned? We're talking about a sovereign God. The fall into sin doesn't change the care of God for his people, for his elect people. Doesn't change his plans, because the fall into sin is his plan. Adam and Eve's fall was his plan. Our sins are in his plan, not because he's justifying them, but because he's going to demonstrate that in spite of what we are, he will keep his promise to us, even if we can't figure out why he would do so. He's sovereign. He rules. He controls all things. If I went to Acts chapter 17, and I won't bore you with reading the whole thing because we've read it so often, God plans when the nations come to power, where they rule, how long they rule, and what they get to rule. Not just the minutiae, but the big things. He rules all. He controls all. Nothing is outside of his plan, from the minutest to the largest of the details. So why do we worry? Because we really don't trust him. We really don't believe him. And I challenge you with that, not because I'm accusing you. Our weakness in terms of lack of confidence, our weakness is because we don't trust him. And we really don't think he's going to keep his word. And we are amazed when he does. And suddenly we're encouraged, because that's his condescension to us. He encourages us to remember that he is keeping care of us all of our days. And he reminds us of that, well, more than three times. In sets of three, maybe. But he reminds us of his care of us. So why do we worry? Because we don't trust. Why do we fear? Because we don't believe he's in charge. There is still in us a warfare that goes on. And that warfare is with our lack of trust of him. Sin. We don't believe him. We don't trust him as we should. Our lives are a growing process of trusting him more and more. And as we do that, we call that growing in grace. And as we trust him more and more, we dare to do more and more like him rather than in the way we would have done it. And so the visions here, and particularly the one we saw today, is designed to give Daniel another set of things to encourage his confidence in the God who has redeemed him. And that same message is for us. Bow with me in prayer. Father, we come before you. We continue